The Girl Who Raised Pigeons by Edward P. Jones. Her father would say years later that she had dreamed that part of it, that she had never gone out through the kitchen window at 2 or 3 in the morning to visit the birds. By that time in his life, he would have so many notions about himself set in concrete, and having always believed that he slept lightly, he would not want to think that a girl of 9 or 10 could walk by him at such an hour in the night without his waking and asking of the dark, "Who is it? What's the matter?" But the night visits were not dreams, and they remained forever as vivid to her as the memory of the way the pigeons' iridescent necklaces flirted with light. The visits would begin not with any compulsion in her sleeping mind to visit, but the simple need to pee or to get a drink of water. In the dark, she went barefoot out of her room, past her father in the front room conversing in his sleep, across the kitchen through the kitchen window, out over the roof a few steps to the coop. It could be winter, it could be summer, but the most she ever got was something she called pigeon silence. Sometimes she had the urge to unlatch the door and go into the coop, or, at the very least, to try to reach through the wire and the wooden slats to stroke a wing or a breast, to share whatever the silence seemed to conceal. But she always kept her hands to herself, and after a few minutes, as if relieved, she would go back to her bed and visit the birds again in sleep. What Betsy Ann Morgan and her father Robert did agree on was that the pigeons began with the barber Miles Patterson. Her father had known Miles long before the girl was born, before the thought to marry her mother had even crossed his mind. The barber lived in a gingerbread brown house with his old parents only a few doors down from the barber shop he owned on the corner of 3rd and L Streets Northwest. On some Sundays, after Betsy Ann had come back from church with Miss Jenny, Robert, as he believed his wife would have done, would take his daughter out to visit with relatives and friends in the neighborhoods just beyond Myrtle Street Northeast, where father and daughter lived. One Sunday, when Betsy Ann was 8 years old, the barber asked her again if she wanted to see his pigeons, my children. He had first asked her some 3 years before. The girl had been eager to see them then, imagining she would see the same frightened creatures who waddled and flew away whenever she chased them on sidewalks and in parks. The men and the girl had gone into backyard, and the pigeons, in a furious greeting, had flown up and about the barber. "Oh, my babies," he said, making kissing sounds. "Daddy's here." In an instant, Miles's head was surrounded by a colorful flutter of pigeon life. The birds settled on his head and his shoulders and along his thick, extended arms, and some of the birds looked down meanly at her. Betsy Ann screamed, sending the birds back into a flutter, which made her scream even louder. And still screaming, she ran back into the house. The men found her in the kitchen, her head buried in the lap of Miles's mother, her arms tied around the waist of the old woman, who had been sitting at the table having Sunday lunch with her husband. "Buster," Miles's mother said to him, "you shouldn't scare your company like this. This child's about to have a heart attack." 3 years later, Betsy Ann said yes again to seeing the birds. In the backyard, there was again the same fluttering chaos, but this time, the sight of the wings and bodies settling about Miles intrigued her, and she drew closer until she was a foot or so away, looking up at them and stretching out her arm as she saw Miles doing. "Oh, my babies," the barber said. "Your daddy's here." One of the birds landed on Betsy Ann's shoulder, and another in the palm of her hand. The gray one in her hand looked dead at Betsy Ann, blinked, then swiveled his head and gave the girl a different view of a radiant black necklace. "They tickle," she said to her father, who stood back. For weeks and weeks after that Sunday, Betsy Ann pestered her father about getting pigeons for her, and the more he told her no, that it was impossible, the more she wanted them. He warned her that he would not do anything to help her care for them. He warned her that all the bird work meant she would not ever again have time to play with her friends. He warned her about all the doo-doo the pigeons would let loose, but she remained a bulldog about it, and he knew that she was not often a bulldog about anything. In the end, he retreated to the fact that they were only renters in Jenny and Walter Creed's house. "Miss Jenny likes birds," the girl said. "Mr. Creed likes birds, too." "People may like birds, but nobody in the world likes pigeons. 'Cept Mr. Miles," she said. "Don't make judgments about things with what you know about Miles." Miles Patterson, a bachelor and, some women said, a virgin, was 56 years old and for the most part knew no more about the world than what he could experience in newspapers or on the radio and in his own neighborhood, beyond which he rarely ventured. "There's ain't nothing out there in the great beyond for me," Miles would say to people who talked with excitement about visiting such and such a place. It was not difficult for the girl to convince Miss Jenny, though the old woman made it known that pigeons carry all them diseases, child. But there were few things that Jenny Creed would deny Betsy Ann. The girl was known by all the world to be a good and obedient child. And in Miss Jenny's eyes, a child's good reputation amounted to an assent from God on most things. For years after he relented, Robert Morgan would rise every morning before his daughter, go out onto the roof, and peer into the coop he had constructed for her, looking for dead pigeons. At such a time in the morning, there would only be fragments of first light, falling in long, hopeful slivers over the birds in their house. Sometimes, he would stare absently into the coop for a long time, because being half asleep, his mind would forget why he was there. The murmuring pigeons, as they did with most of the world, would stare back, with looks more of curiosity than fear or anticipation or welcome. He thought that by getting there in the morning before his daughter, he could spare her the sight and pain of any dead birds. His plan had always been to put any dead birds he found into a burlap sack, take them down to his taxicab, and dispose of them on his way to work. He never intended to tell her about such birds, and it never occurred to him that she would know every pigeon in the coop and would wonder, perhaps even worry, about a missing bird. They lived in the apartment Jenny and Walter Creed had made out of the upstairs in their Myrtle Street house. Miss Jenny had known Clara, Robert's wife, practically all of Clara's life, but their relationship had become little more than hellos and goodbyes as they passed in the street before. Miss Jenny came upon Clara and Robert one rainy Saturday in the library park at Mount Vernon Square. Miss Jenny had come out of Hahn's shoe store, crossed New York Avenue, and was going up 7th Street. At first, Miss Jenny thought the young man and woman, soaked through to the skin, sitting on the park bench under a blue umbrella, were feeble-minded or straight-out crazy. As she came closer, she could hear them laughing, and the young man was swinging the umbrella back and forth over their heads, so that the rain would fall first upon her and then upon himself. "Ain't you William and Alice Hobson, baby girl?" Miss Jenny asked Clara. "Yes, ma'am," she stood, and Robert stood as well, now holding the umbrella fully over Clara's head. "Is everything all right, child?" Miss Jenny's glasses were spotted with mist, and she took them off and stepped closer, keeping safely to the side where Clara was. "Yes, ma'am. She pushed Robert and began to laugh. "We came out of Peoples, and he wouldn't let me have none of the umbrella. He let me get wet, so I took the umbrella and let him have some of his own medicine." Robert said nothing. He was standing out of the range of the umbrella, and he was getting soaked all over again. "We gonna get married, Miss Jenny," she said, as if that explained everything, and she stuck out her hand with a ring. "From Castleberg's," she said. Miss Jenny took Clara's hand and held it close to her face. Oh, she said again and again, pulling Clara's hand still closer. "This Robert," Clara said, "my," and she turned to look at him, "fiancé." She uttered the word with certain crispness. It was clear that before Robert Morgan, fiancé was a word she had perhaps never uttered in her life. Robert and Miss Jenny shook hands. "You gonna give her double pneumonia even before she take your name," she said. The couple learned the next week that the place above Miss Jenny was vacant, and the following Sunday, Clara and Robert, dressed as if they had just come from church, were at her front door, inquiring about the apartment. That was one of the last days in the park for them. Robert came to believe later that the tumor that would consume his wife's brain had been growing even on that rainy day, and it was there all those times he made love to her. And the thought that it was there, perhaps at first no bigger than a grain of salt, made him feel that he had somehow used her, taken her, even as she was moving toward death. He would not remember until much, much later, the time she told him he gave her pleasure, when she whispered into his ear that she was glad she had found him, raised her head in that bed as she lay under him. And when he did remember, he would have to take out her photograph from the small box of valuables he kept in the dresser's top drawer, for he could not remember her face any other way. Clara spent most of the first months of her pregnancy in bed, propped up, reading movie magazines and listening to the radio, waiting for Robert to come home from work. Her once pretty face slowly began to collapse in on itself like fruit too long in the sun, eaten away by the rot that despoiled from the inside out. The last month or so, she spent in the bed on the third floor at Gallagher Hospital. One morning, toward 4 o'clock, they cut open her stomach and pulled out the child only moments after Clara died. Mother and daughter passing each other as if along a corridor, one into death, the other into life. The weeks after her death, Robert and the infant were attended to by family and friends. They catered to him and to the baby to such an extent that sometimes in those weeks when he heard her cry, he would look about at the people in a room, momentarily confused about what was making the sound. But as all the people returned to their lives in other parts of Washington or in other cities, he was left with the ever-increasing vastness of the small apartment and with a being who hadn't the power to ask, yet seemed to demand everything. "I don't think I can do this," he confessed to Miss Jenny one Friday evening when the baby was about a month old, I know I can't do this. Robert's father had been the last to leave him, and Robert had just returned from taking the old man to Union Station a few blocks away. If my daddy had just said the word, I'd have been on that train with him. He and Miss Jenny were sitting at his kitchen table, and the child, sleeping, was in her cradle beside Miss Jenny. Miss Jenny watched him and said not a word. Would have followed him all the way back home. I never looked down the line and saw being by myself like this. It's all right, Miss Jenny said finally. I know how it is. You a young man. You got a whole life in front of you. And the stone on his heart grew lighter. The city people can help out with this.
The city?
He looked through the fluttering curtain onto the roof, at the oak tree at the back of houses on K Street.
Yes, yes.
She turned around in her chair to face him fully. My niece works for the city, and she say they can take care of children like this who don't have parents. They have homes, good homes, for children like her.
Bring them up real good. Feed them, clothe them, give them good schooling, give them everything they need.
She stood, as if the matter were settled.
The city people care. Call my niece tomorrow and find out what you need to do. A young man like you shouldn't have to worry yourself like this.
She was at the door, and he stood up, too, not wanting her to go.
Try to put all the worries out your mind.
Before he could say anything, she closed the door quietly behind her. She did not come back up, as he had hoped, and he spent his first night alone with the child. Each time he managed to get the baby back to sleep after he fed her or changed her diaper, he would place her in the crib in the front room and sit without light at the kitchen table, listening to the trains coming and going just beyond his window. He was 19 years old. There was a song about trains that kept rumbling in his head as the night wore on, a song his mother would sing when he was a boy. The next morning, Saturday, he shaved and washed up while Betsy Ann was still sleeping, and after she woke and he had fed her again, he clothed her with a yellow outfit and its yellow bonnet that Wilma Ellis, the school teacher next door, had given Betsy Ann. He carried the carriage downstairs first, leaving the baby on a pallet of blankets. On the sidewalk, he covered her with a light green blanket that Dr. Oscar Jackson and his family up the street had given the baby. The shades were down at Miss Jenny's windows, and he heard no sound, not even the dogs barking as he came and went. At the child's kicking feet in the carriage, he placed enough diapers and powdered formula to last an expedition to Baltimore. Beside her, he placed a blue rattle from the janitor Jake Horton across the street. He was the only moving object within her sight, and she watched him intently, which made him uncomfortable. She seemed the most helpless thing he had ever known. It occurred to him perversely, as he settled her in, that if he decided to walk away forever from her and the carriage and all her stuff, to walk but a few yards and make his way up or down First Street, for no place in particular, there was not a damn thing in the world she could do about it. The carriage was facing First Street northeast, and with some effort, because one of the wheels refused to turn with the others, he maneuvered it around, pointing toward North Capitol Street. In those days, before the community was obliterated, a warm Myrtle Street Saturday morning filled both sidewalks and the narrow street itself with playing children oblivious to everything but their own merriment. A grown-up's course was generally not an easy one, but that morning, as he made his way with the soundless wheels of the carriage, the children made way for Robert Morgan, for he was the man whose wife had passed away. At her wake, some of them had been held up by grown-ups so they could look down on Clara laid out in her pink casket in Miss Jenny's parlor. And though death and its rituals did not mean much beyond the wavering understanding that they would never see someone again, they knew from what their parents said and did that a clear path to the corner was perhaps the very least a widow man deserved. Some of the children called to their parents, still in their houses and apartments, that Robert was passing with Clara's baby. The few grown-ups on porches came down to the sidewalk and made a fuss over Betsy Ann. More than midway down the block, Janet Gordon, who had been one of Clara's best friends, came out and picked up the baby. It was too nice a day to have the blanket over her, she told Robert. You expecting to go all the way to Baltimore with all them diapers? She said. It would be Janet who would teach him, practicing on string and a discarded blonde-haired doll how to part and plait a girl's hair. He did not linger on Myrtle Street. He planned to make visits there on his way back that evening. Janet's boys, Carlos and Carlton, walked on either side of him up Myrtle to North Capitol, then to the corner of K Street. There they knew to turn back. Carlos, 7 years old, told him to take it easy. Carlton, younger by 2 years, did not want to repeat what his brother said, so he repeated one of the things his grandfather, who was losing his mind, always told him. Don't get lost in the city. Robert nodded as if he understood, and the boys turned back. He took off his tie and put it in his pocket and unbuttoned his suit coat and the top two buttons of his shirt. Then he adjusted his hat and placed the rattle nearer the baby, who paid it no mind.
And when the light changed, he maneuvered the carriage down off the sidewalk and crossed North Capitol into Northwest. Miles the barber gave Betsy Ann two pigeons, yearlings, a dull white female with black spots and a sparkling red male. For several weeks in the morning, soon after she had dutifully gone in to fill the feed dish and replace the water, and after they had fortified themselves, the pigeons took to the air and returned to Miles. The forlorn sound of their flapping wings echoed in her head as she stood watching them disappear into the colors of the morning, often still holding the broom she used to sweep out their coop. So in those first weeks, she went first to Miles's after school to retrieve the pigeons, usually bringing along Ralph Holly, her cousin. Miles would put the birds in the two pigeon baskets Robert would bring over each morning before he took to the street in his taxicab. "They don't like me," Betsy Ann said to Miles one day in the second week. "They're just gonna keep on flying away. They hate me." Miles laughed, the same way he laughed when she asked him the first day how he knew one was a girl pigeon and the other was a boy pigeon. "I don't think that they even got to the place of liking or not liking you," Miles said. She handed her books to Ralph, and Miles gave her the two baskets. "Well, they keep running away. That's all they know to do," which is what he had told her the week before. "Right now, this is all the home they know for sure. It ain't got nothing to do with you, child. They just know to fly back here." His explanations about everything, when he could manage an explanation, rarely satisfied her. He had been raising pigeons all his life, and whatever knowledge he had accumulated in those years was now such an inseparable part of his being that he could no more explain the birds than he could explain what went into the act of walking. He only knew that they did all that birds did and not something else, as he only knew that he walked and did not fall. "You might try locking them in for a while," he said. "Maybe 2-3 days, however long it take them to get used to the new home. Let them know you the boss, and you ain't gonna stand for none of this running away stuff." She considered a moment, then shook her head. She watched her cousin peering into Miles's coop, his face hard against the wire. "I guess if I gotta lock them up, there ain't no use having them." "Why you wanna mess with the goddamn pigeons anyway?" Ralph said as they walked to her home that day. "Because," she said. "Because what?" he said. "Because, that's all," she said. "Just because." "You ought to get a puppy like I'm gonna get," Ralph said. "A puppy never run away. A puppy never fly either. So what?" she said. "You've been talking about getting a goddamn puppy for 1,000,000 years, but I never see you getting one." Though Ralph was a year older and a head taller than his cousin, she often bullied him. "You wait, you wait, you'll see," Ralph said. "I ain't waiting. You the one waiting. When you get it, just let me know and I'll throw you a big party." At her place, he handed over her books and went home. She considered following her cousin back to his house after she took the pigeons up to the coop, for the idea of being on the roof with birds who wanted to fly away to be with someone else pained her. At Ralph's L Street house, there were cookies almost as big as her face, and Aunt Thelma, Clara's oldest sister, who was in fact the very image of Clara. The girl had never had an overwhelming curiosity about her mother, but it fascinated her to see the face of the lady in all the pictures on a woman who moved and laughed and did mother things. She put the pigeons back in the coop and put fresh water in the bath bowls. Then she stood back outside the coop, its door open. At such moments, they often seemed contented, hopping in and out of cubicles, inspecting the feed and water, all of which riled her. She would have preferred and understood agitation, some sign they were unhappy and ready to fly to Miles again. But they merely pecked about, strutted, heads bobbing happily, oblivious of her, pretending everything was all right. "You shitheads," she hissed, aware that Miss Jenny was downstairs within earshot. "You goddamn stupid shitheads." That was the fall of 1957. Myrtle Street was only one long block, running east to west. To the east, preventing the street from going any farther, was a high medieval wall of stone across First Street northeast, and beyond the wall were the railroad tracks. To the west, across North Capitol, preventing Myrtle Street from going any further in that direction, was the High School Gonzaga, where white boys were taught by white priests. When the colored people in their homes were gone, the wall and the tracks remained, and so did the high school, with the same boys being taught by the same priests. It was late spring when Betsy Ann first noticed the nest, some 2 feet up from the coop's floor in one of the 12 cubicles that made up the entire structure. The nest was nothing special, a crude, ill-formed thing of straw and dead leaves and other uncertain material she figured only her hapless birds could manage to find. They had not flown back to Miles in a long time, but she had never stopped thinking that it was on their minds each time they took to the air. So the nest was the first solid indication that the pigeons would stay forever, would go, but would always return. About 3 weeks later, on an afternoon when she was about to begin the weekly job of thoroughly cleaning the entire coop, she saw the two eggs. She thought them a trick of the light at first, two small and perfect wonders alone in the wonderless nest, without any hallelujahs from the world. She put off the cleaning and stood looking at the male bird, who had moved off the nest for only a few seconds, rearrange himself on the nest, and look at her from time to time in that bored way he had. The female was atop the coop, dozing. Betsy Ann got a chair from the kitchen and continued watching the male bird and the nest through the wire. "Tell me about this," she said to them. As it happened, Robert discovered the newly hatched squabs when he went to look for dead birds before going to work. About 6 that morning, he peered into the coop and shivered to find two hideous, bug-eyed balls of movement. They were a dirty orange and looked like baby vultures. He looked about as if there might be someone responsible for it all. This was, he knew now, a point of no return for his child. He went back in to have his first cup of coffee of the day. He drank without enjoyment and listened to the chirping, unsettling, demanding. He would not wake his daughter just to let her know about the hatchlings. Two little monsters had changed the predictable world he was trying to create for his child, and he was suddenly afraid for her. He turned on the radio and played it real low, but he soon shut it off because the man on WOOK was telling him to go in and kill the hatchlings. It turned out that the first pigeon to die was a stranger, and Robert never knew anything about it. The bird appeared out of nowhere and was dead less than a week later. By then, a year or so after Miles gave her the yearlings, she had 8 birds of various ages resulting from hatches in her coop and from trades with the barber. "For variety's sake," he told her, "and with a family in Anacostia." One morning before going to school, she noticed the stranger perched in one of the lower cubicles, a few inches up from the floor, and though he seemed submissive enough, she sensed that he would peck with all he had if she tried to move him out. His entire body, what little there was left of it, was a witness to misery. One ragged cream-colored tail feather stuck straight up, as if with resignation. His bill was pitted, as if it had been sprayed with minute pellets, and his left eye was covered with a patch of dried blood and dirt and decaying flesh. She placed additional straw to either side of him in the cubicle and small bowls of water and feed in front of the cubicle. Then she began to worry that he had brought in some disease that would ultimately devastate her flock. Days later, home for lunch with Ralph, she found the pigeon dead near the water tray, his wings spread out full as if he had been preparing for flight. "What you gonna do with him?" Ralph asked, kneeling down beside Betsy Ann and poking the dead bird with a pencil. "Bury him. What else, stupid?" She snatched the pencil from him. "You don't think any of them gonna do it, do you?" And she pointed to the few stay-at-home pigeons who were not out flying about the city. The birds looked down uninterestedly at them from various places around the coop. She dumped the dead bird in a pillowcase and took it across First Street to the grassy spot of ground near the SO filling station in front of the medieval wall. With a large tablespoon, she dug 2 feet or so in the earth and dropped the sack in. "Beaver would say something over his grave," Ralph said. "What?" "Beaver, the boy on TV." She gave him a cut-eye look and stood up. "You do it, preacher man," she said. "I gotta get back to school." After school, she said to Miss Jenny, "Don't tell Daddy about that dead pigeon. You know how he is. He'll think it's the end of the world or something." The two were in Miss Jenny's kitchen, and Miss Jenny was preparing supper while Betsy Ann did her homework. "You know what he do in the morning?" Betsy Ann said. "He go out and look at them pigeons." "Oh." Miss Jenny, who knew what Robert had been doing, did not turn around from the stove. "Wants to say good morning to him, huh?" "I don't think so. I ain't figured out what he doing," the girl said. She was sitting at Miss Jenny's kitchen table. The dog, Bosco, was beside her, and one of her shoes was off and her foot was rubbing the dog's back. "I was sleeping one time, and this cold air hit me and I woke up. I couldn't get back to sleep because I was so cold, so I got up to see what window was open. Daddy wasn't in the bed, and he wasn't in the kitchen or the bathroom. I thought he was downstairs warming up the cab or something, but when I went to close the kitchen window, I could see him peeking in the coop from the side with a flashlight. He scared me because I didn't know who he was at first." "You ask him what he was doing?" "No. He wouldn't have told me anyway, Miss Jenny. I went back to my room and closed the door. If I'd asked him straight out, he would just make up something or say maybe I was dreaming. So now, when I feel that cold air, I just look out to see if he in bed, and then I shut my door." Sometimes, when the weather allowed, the girl would sit on the roof plaiting her hair or reading the funny papers before school, or sit down doing her homework in the late afternoon before going down to Miss Jenny's or out to play. She got pleasure just from the mere presence of the pigeons, a pleasure that was akin to what she felt when she followed her Aunt Thelma about her house, or when she jumped double dutch for so long she had to drop to the ground to catch her breath. In the morning, the new sun rising higher, She would place her chair at the roof's edge. She could look down at tail-wagging Bosco looking up at her, down through the thick rope fence around the roof that Robert had put up when she was a year old. She would hum or sing some nonsense song she had made up as the birds strutted and pecked and preened and flapped about in the bathwater. And in the evening, she watched the pigeons return home, first landing in the oak tree, then over to the coop's landing board. A few of them, generally the males, would settle on her book or on her head and shoulders. Stroking the breast of one, she would be rewarded with a cooing that was as pleasurable as music. And when the bird edged nearer, so that it was less than an inch away, she smelled what seemed a mixture of dirt and rainy air and heard a heart that seemed to be hurling itself against the wall of the bird's breast. She turned 10. She turned 11. In the early summer of 1960, there began a rumor among the children of Betsy Ann's age that the railroad people were planning to take all the land around Myrtle Street, perhaps up to L Street and down to H Street. This rumor, unlike the summer rumor among Washington's Negro children that Richard Nixon, if he were elected president, would make all the children go to school on Saturday from 9 to 12 and cut their summer vacations in half, this rumor had a long life. And as the boys scraped their knuckles on the ground playing poison, as the girls jumped rope until their bouncing plats came loose, as the boys filled the neighborhood with the sounds of amateur hammering as they built skating trucks, as the girls made up talk for dolls with names they would one day bestow on their children, their conversations were flavored with lighthearted speculation about how far the railroad would go. When one child fell out with another, it became standard to try to hurt the other with the true fact that the railroad was going to take his or her home. "It's a true fact. They called my daddy at his work and told him we could stay, but y'all gotta go. Y'all gotta." And then the tormentor would stick out his or her tongue as far as it would go. There were only two other girls on Myrtle Street who were comfortable around pigeons, and both of them moved away within a month of each other. One, LaDedra Gordon, was a cousin of the brothers Carlos and Carlton. LaDedra believed that the pigeons spoke a secret language among themselves, and that if she listened long enough and hard enough, she could understand what they were saying and ultimately could communicate with them. For this, the world lovingly nicknamed her Cuckoo. After LaDedra and the second girl moved, Betsy Ann would take the long way around to avoid passing where they had lived. And in those weeks, she found a comfort of sorts at Thelma and Ralph's. For their house and everything else on the other side of North Capitol Street, the rumor went, would be spared by the railroad people. Thelma Holly, her husband, and Ralph lived in a small house on L Street, Northwest, two doors from Mount Airy Baptist Church, just across North Capitol Street. Thelma had suffered 6 miscarriages before God, as she put it, took pity on my womb, and she had Ralph. But even then, she felt God had given with one hand and taken with the other, for the boy suffered with asthma. Thelma had waited until the 7th month of her pregnancy before she felt secure enough to begin loving him. And from then on, having given her heart, she thought nothing of giving him the world after he was born. Ralph was the first colored child anyone knew to have his own television. In his house, there had been 3 bedrooms, but Thelma persuaded her husband that an asthmatic child needed more space. Her husband knocked down the walls between the 2 back bedrooms, and Ralph then had a bedroom that was nearly twice as large as that of his parents. And in that enormous room, she put as much of the world as she and her husband could afford. Aside from watching Thelma, what Betsy Ann enjoyed most in that house was the electric train set, which dominated the center of Ralph's room. Over an area of more than 4 square feet, running on 3 levels, the train moved through a marvelous and complete world Ralph's father had constructed. In that world, there were no simple plastic figures waving beside the tracks. Rather, it was populated with such people as a hand-carved woman of wood in a floppy hat and gardener's outfit of real cloth. A woman who had nearly microscopic beads of sweat on her brow as she knelt down with concentration in her flower garden. Several inches away, hand-carved school children romped about in the playground. One group of children was playing tag, and on one boy's face was absolute surprise as he was being tagged by a girl whose cheek was lightly smudged with dirt. A foot or so away, in a small field, 2 hand-carved farmers of wood were arguing, one with his finger in the other's face, and the other with his fist heading toward the chest of the first. The world also included a goat-populated mountain with a tunnel large enough for the trains to go through, and a stream made of light blue glass. The stream covered several tiny fish of many colors, which had almost invisible pins holding them suspended from the bottom up to give the impression that the fish were swimming. What Thelma would not put in her son's enormous room, despite years of pleadings from him, was a dog, for she had learned in childhood that all animals had the power to suck the life out of asthmatics. "What you need was some old puppy," she would tease sometimes when he asked. "You'll be my little puppy dog forever and ever." and then she would grab and hug him until he wiggled out of her arms. By the time he was 6, the boy had learned that he could sometimes stay all day in the room and have Thelma minister to him by pretending he could barely breathe. He hoped that over time, he could get out of her a promise for a dog, but his pretending to be at death's door only made her worry more. And by the middle of 1961, she had quit her part-time GS-4 clerk typist position at the Interior Department because by then, he was home 2 or 3 times a week. Gradually, as more people moved out of Myrtle Street, the room became less attractive for Betsy Ann to visit, for Ralph grew difficult and would be mean and impatient with her and other visiting children. "You stupid, that's all. You just the stupidest person in the whole wide world," he would say to anyone who did not do what he wanted as fast as he wanted. Some children cried when he lit into them, and others wanted to fight him. In time, the boy Betsy Ann once bullied disappeared altogether. And so when she took him assignments from school, she tried to stay only the amount of time necessary to show politeness. Then, too, the girl sensed that Thelma, with her increasing coldness, felt her son's problem was partly the results of visits from children who weren't altogether clean, and from a niece who lived her life in what Thelma called pigeon air and pigeon dust. When he found out, the details of it did not matter to Robert Morgan. He only knew that his daughter had been somewhere doing bad while he was out doing the best he could. It didn't matter that it was Darlene Greenlee who got Betsy Ann to go far away to 7th and Massachusetts and steal candy bars from People's Drug, candy she didn't even like, to go away the farthest she had ever been without her father or Miss Jenny or some other adult. She knew Darlene, fast Darlene, from going to Ralph's.
"You watch and see," Darlene would whisper to her. "I'm gonna make him my boyfriend."
But they had never gone off together before the Saturday that Thelma, for the last time, expelled all the children from her house.
"Got any money?"
Darlene said on the sidewalk after Thelma had thrown them out. She was stretching the bubble gum between her teeth and fingers and swirling the stuff the way she would a jump rope. When Betsy Ann shook her head, Darlene said she knew this Peoples that kind of like, you know, gave children candy just for stopping by, and Betsy Ann believed her. The assistant manager caught the girls before they were out of the candy and toy aisle, and right away Darlene started to cry.
"That didn't work the last time I told you to stay out of here,"
the woman said, taking the candy out of their dress pockets, "and it ain't gonna work now." Darlene handed her candy over, and Betsy Ann did the same. Darlene continued to cry.
"Oh, just shut up, you little hussy, before I give you something to really cry about."
The assistant manager handed the candy to a clerk and was about to drag the girls to the back room when Etta O'Connell came up the aisle.
"Your daddy know you this far from home, Betsy Ann?"
Miss Etta said, tapping Betsy Ann in the chest with her walking stick. She was, at 92, the oldest person on Myrtle Street. It surprised Betsy Ann that she even knew her name, because the old woman, as far as Betsy Ann could remember, had never once spoken a word to her.
"You know these criminals?"
the assistant manager said.
"Know this one since the day she was born,"
Miss Etta said. The top of her stick had the head of an animal that no one had been able to identify, and the animal, perched a foot or so higher than Miss Etta's head, looked down at Betsy Ann with a "better you than me" look. The old woman uncurled the fingers of the assistant manager's hand from around Betsy Ann's arm.
"Child, what you done in this lady's store?"
In the end, the assistant manager accepted Miss Etta's word that Betsy Ann would never again step foot in the store, that her father would know what she had done the minute he got home. Outside, standing at the corner, Miss Etta raised her stick and pointed to K Street.
"You don't go straight home with no stopping, I'll know,"
she said to Betsy Ann, and the girl sprinted off, never once looking back. Miss Etta and Darlene continued standing at the corner.
"I think that old lady gave me the evil eye," Darlene told Betsy Ann the next time they met. "She done took all my good luck away. Y'all got ghosties and shit on your street."
And thereafter, she avoided Betsy Ann. Robert tanned her hide, as Miss Jenny called it, and then withheld her 50 cents a week allowance for 2 months. For some 3 weeks, he said very little to her. And when he did, it was almost always the same words. "You should be here, taking care of them damn birds. That's where you should be, not out there robbing somebody's grocery store." She stopped correcting him about what kind of store it was after the first few times, because each time she did, he would say, "Who the grown up here? You starting to sound like you running the show." The candy episode killed something between them, and more he began checking up on her. He would show up at the house when she thought he was out working. She would come out of the coop with a bag of feed, or the broom in her hand and a bird sitting on her head, and she would find him standing at the kitchen window watching her. And several times a day he would call Miss Jenny.
"Yo, daddy want to know if you up there,"
Miss Jenny would holler out her back window. Robert called the school so much that the principal herself wrote a letter telling him to stop. He had been seeing Janet Gordon for 2 years, and about 3 or 4 times a month, they would take in a movie or show at the Howard and then spend the night at a tourist home.
But after the incident at People's, he saw Janet only once or twice a month. Then he began taking his daughter with him in the cab on most Saturdays. He tried to make it seem as if it were a good way to see the city. Despite his reasons for taking her along, she enjoyed riding with him at first. She asked him for one of his old maps, and with a blue crayon, she would chart the streets of Washington she had been on. Her father spent most of his time in Southeast and in Anacostia, but sometimes he went as far away as Virginia and Maryland, and she charted streets in those places as well. She also enjoyed watching him at work, seeing a part of him she had never known, the way he made deliberate notations in his log, patted his thigh in time to music in his head until he noticed her looking at him, raised his hat anytime a woman entered or left the cab. But the more she realized that being with him was just his way of keeping his eye on her, the more the travels began losing something for her. When she used the bathroom at some filling station during her travels, she found him waiting for her outside the bathroom door, his nail-bitten hands down at his sides, his hat sitting perfectly on his head, and a look on his face that said nothing. Nothing's wrong. Before the autumn of 1961 had settled in, she only wanted to be left at home. And because the incident at People's was far behind them, he allowed it. But he went back to the old ways of checking up on her. "Tell him yes," she would say when Miss Jenny called out her back window. "Tell him a million times, yes, I'm home." Little by little, that spring and summer of 1961, Myrtle Street emptied of people, of families who had known no other place in their lives. Robert dreaded coming home each evening and seeing the signs of still another abandoned house, free to be picked clean by rogues coming in from other neighborhoods. Old curtains flapping out of screenless windows. The street with every kind of litter, windows so naked he could see clean through to the backyard. For the first time since he had been knowing her, Miss Jenny did not plant her garden that year, and that small patch of ground with alien growth tall as man reverted to the wild. He vowed that until he could find a good place for himself and his child, he would try to make life as normal as possible for her. He had never stopped rising each morning before Betsy Ann and going out to the coop to see what pigeons might have died in the night. And that was what he did that last morning in mid-autumn. He touched down on the roof and discovered it had snowed during the night, a light nuisance powder, not thick enough to cover the world completely and make things beautiful the way he liked. Though there was enough sunlight, he did not at first notice the tiny tracks, with even tinier intermittent spots of blood, leading from the coop across his roof and over to the roof of the house next door, the schoolteacher's house that had been empty for more than 4 months. He did, however, hear the birds squawking before he reached the coop. But this meant nothing to him, because one pigeon would sound more or less like another to him. The night before, there had been 16 pigeons of various ages, but when he reached the coop, 5 were already dead, and 3 were in their last moments, dragging themselves crazily about the floor or from side to side in the lower cubicles. 6 of them he would kill with his own hands. Though there were bodies with holes so deep he saw white flesh, essence, it was the sight of the dozens of detached feathers that caused his body to shake. Because the scattered feathers, more than the wrecked body, spoke to him of helplessness. He closed his eyes as tight as he could and began to pray. And when he opened them, the morning was even brighter. He looked back at the window, for something had whispered that Betsy Ann was watching. But he was alone, and he went into the coop. He took up one dead bird whose left wing and legs had been chewed off. He shook the bird gently, and gently he blew into its face. He prayed once more. The pigeons that were able had moved to the farthest corner of the coop and they watched him, quivering. He knew now that the squawking was the sound of pain and it drove him out of their house. When he saw the tracks, he realized immediately that they had been made by rats. He bent down, and some logical piece of his mind was surprised that there was a kind of orderliness to the trail, even with his ragged bits of pigeon life, a fragment of feathers here, a spot of blood there. He did not knock at Walter and Miss Jenny's door and wait to go in, as he had done each morning for some 13 years. He found them at the breakfast table, and because they had been used to 13 years of knocking, they looked up at him, amazed. Most of his words were garbled, but they followed him back upstairs. Betsy Ann had heard the noise of her father coming through the kitchen window and bounded down the stairs. She stood barefoot in the doorway leading from the front room to the kitchen, blinking herself awake. "Go back to bed," Robert shouted at her. When she asked what was the matter, the three only told her to go back to bed. From the kitchen closet, Robert took 2 burlap sacks. Walter followed him out onto the roof, and Betsy Ann made her way around Miss Jenny to the window. Her father shouted at her to go to her room, and Miss Jenny tried to grab her, but she managed to get onto the roof where Walter held her. From inside, she had heard the squawking, a brand new sound for her. Even with Walter holding her, she got a few feet from the coop, and when Robert told her to go back inside, she gave him the only no of their lives.
He looked but once at her, and then began to wring the necks of the birds injured beyond all hope. Strangely, when he reached for them, the pigeons did not peck, did not resist. He placed all of the bodies in the sacks, and when he was all done and stood covered in blood and viscera and feathers, he began to cry. Betsy Ann and her father noticed almost simultaneously that there were two birds completely unharmed, huddled in an upper corner of the coop. After he tied the mouths of the sacks, the two birds, as if of one mind, flew together to the landing board and from there to the oak tree in Miss Jenny's yard. Then they were gone. The girl buried her face in Walter's side, and when the old man saw that she was barefoot, he picked her up. She missed them more than she ever thought she would. In school, her mind would wander, and she would doodle so many pigeons on the backs of her hands and along her arms that teachers called her nasty, nasty girl. In the bathtub at night, she would cry to have to wash them off, and as she slept, missing them would take shape and lean down over her head and wake her just enough to get her to understand a whisper that told her all over again how much she missed them. And when she raged in her sleep, Robert would come in and hold her until she returned to peace. He would sit in a chair beside her bed for the rest of the night, for her rages usually came about 4 a.m, and with the night so near morning, he saw no use in going back to bed. She roamed the city at will, and Robert said nothing. She came to know the city so well that had she been blindfolded and taken to practically any place in Washington, even as far away as Anacostia or Georgetown, she could have taken off the blindfold and walked home without a moment's trouble. Her favorite place became the Library Park at Mount Vernon Square, the same park where Miss Jenny had first seen Robert and Clara together, across the street from the people's where Betsy Ann had been caught stealing. And there, on some warm days, Robert would find her, sitting on a bench, or lying on the grass, eyes to the sky. For many weeks, well into winter, one of the birds that had not been harmed would come to the ledge of a back window of an abandoned house that faced K Street. The bird, a typical gray, would stand on the ledge and appear to look across the backyards in the direction of Betsy Ann's roof, now an empty space because the coop had been dismantled for use as firewood in Miss Jenny's kitchen stove. When the girl first noticed him and realized who he was, she said nothing. But after a few days, she began to call to him, beseech him to come to her. She came to the very edge of the roof, for now the rope fence was gone and nothing held her back. When the bird would not come to her, she cursed him. After as much as an hour, it would fly away and return the next morning. On what turned out to be the last day, a very cold morning in February, she stepped out onto the roof to drink the last of her cocoa. At first she sipped, then took one final swallow, and in the time it took her to raise the cup to her lips and lower it, the pigeon had taken a step and dropped from the ledge. He caught an upwind that took him nearly as high as the tops of the empty K Street houses. He flew farther into northeast, into the colors and sounds of the city's morning. She did nothing, aside from following him with her eyes, with her heart, as far as she could.